This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. President Obama is pushing hard for a consensus on health care legislation. Before Congress adjourns for the summer, he'll convene a primetime news conference this week to further press his cause, which he took directly to the American people in unscheduled remarks late Friday afternoon.
We are going to get this done. We will reform health care. It will happen this year.
That goal, however, has already hit a snag. A report issued Thursday by the Congressional Budget Office that says none of the health reform proposals floated so far will achieve his goal of curbing the skyrocketing rate of health care costs. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Leanne.
Tell us why the Congressional Budget Office report was such a big setback for the president.
It was a big setback because it played right into the hands of the president's critics, who say that his plan is going to increase the deficit, raise taxes, and not bring health care costs down, not fix the health care problem. He has been out there pushing very hard, saying health care reform is not just to get everybody covered. Health care reform is to lower costs. The problem is that he has been saying that his plan would bring down costs without adding to the deficit, and the CBO, who is the official umpire, the impartial fiscal umpire on Capitol Hill, has just said the plans out there so far, and there are more plans to come, will not do that.
Explain for us how paying for health care reform relates to keeping costs under control and why it's going to be so hard for the president to achieve both of those goals.
Well, the biggest piece of paying for health care reform is paying the subsidies for all those people who you want to bring into the health insurance system. Then you have to also try to keep costs under control, just as you're now spending tremendous amounts of more money on health care.
Is there any consensus at all about maybe there's a best way to bring down the cost of health care?
There's a lot of ideas out there. One of the ideas that most experts agree on is that we should stop subsidizing these gold-plated Cadillac insurance plans that many people get from their employers. They get them tax-free. So somebody who's making $50,000 with no health insurance right now is, in effect, subsidizing someone who makes maybe $150,000. Maybe they're in a union who's managed to negotiate a really good health care plan with their employer, which they get tax-free. The president and the Congress doesn't want to get rid of that tax exclusion, even though the CBO chairman, Doug Elmendorf, said that is one of the best ways we can do it. The other way is what President Obama talked about on Friday. He calls it delivery system reform, where you would change the whole way that people get health care. Right now, it's very expensive and we don't get high quality. He wants there to be an independent group of doctors and medical experts which would review the payment policies for Medicare programs, issue recommendations to Congress. They are the ones who would, in effect, say no to an 88-year-old woman with cancer. No, we will not pay for your hip replacement.
How legitimate is the concern that Republicans have that any sort of bundled payment system would lead to rationing of health care?
Well, there's a big debate over rationing, and of course some people say health care is rationed right now. Health insurers say no to people all the time. No, we won't pay for this. This would be maybe a more rational way to do that. But that is the specter that this raises. One of the problems with this whole health delivery system reform is that nobody really knows how to do it yet. In a town meeting I went to with the president a couple of weeks ago, he said it's going to take us 4 to 5 years to just get the structures in place so we can figure out how to do this, deliver higher quality health care at lower cost. Some communities in the country do it better than others right now. How do you enforce or put the incentives in place to get those best practices replicated all over the country? And one of the biggest problems, political problems for the president and Congress right now, is the Congressional Budget Office can't score that as savings because nobody knows how to do it, and it probably would take more than 10 years to actually get savings, and the CBO only deals in 10-year increments.
NPR's political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you very much.
Thank you, Leanne.
We turn to Frank McCourt, the Irish-American writer who turned his grim childhood into the best-selling memoir Angela's Ashes. He died today. He was 78 years old. McCourt had been gravely ill with meningitis and was being treated for skin cancer. Malachy McCourt, also a writer, said his brother died this afternoon at a New York hospice. Frank McCourt's success came late in life. He was a retired schoolteacher in his 60s when he wrote Angela's Ashes. He followed that story up with two more memoirs. NPR's Lynn Neary has this remembrance.
It took Frank McCourt almost a lifetime to absorb the blows of his childhood so thoroughly that he was able to write about his bleak upbringing in an alcoholic household in Limerick, Ireland, in a way that made other people want to read about it. When Angela's Ashes was first published, the New York Times Review noted there was not a trace of bitterness or resentment in it. But McCourt told interviewers that there had been anger, and he had to get over it in order to write the book. He also had to learn to believe that his story was worth telling. During an interview with NPR in 1999, McCourt said he began to understand that when he moved to this country and started reading the work of Sean O'Casey.
O'Casey was writing about people in the streets and his mother and dying babies and poverty. So that astounded me, because I thought you could only write about English matters. I didn't know you could write about yourself. Nobody ever told me about this.
While he was writing Angela's Ashes, McCourt used to hang out in a bar in Greenwich Village called the Lion's Head, and it was there that he became friends with the writer Mary Breasted. He asked her to read the book. She was stunned by its restrained tragedy and transcendent humor.
I stayed up late. I had young children then, and I was a tired mother, and I did not stop reading it until it was done, and my husband was annoyed because I was laughing and making noise in the bed next to him. I just thought it was the best work on growing up in Ireland that I'd read since James Joyce and Portrait of the Artist.
Breasted helped McCourt find an agent, and the book was published in 1996 when McCourt was 66 years old. Angela's Ashes was wildly popular, staying atop the bestseller lists for 2 years. McCourt won numerous awards, including the 1997 Pulitzer Prize. Breasted says McCourt handled his newfound fame remarkably well.
He's handled it better than anybody I've ever known. You know, he just didn't turn into a jerk who was famous. He didn't leave his wife. He didn't forget his old friends. He just was supremely happy, but he kept a kind of grounded, sort of somber sense of the realities of life.
McCourt's second memoir, Tis, took up the story of his life when he moved to this country at the age of 19. His third book, Teacher Man, was the story of his years as a teacher in the New York City school system. With all his success, McCourt didn't give up teaching entirely. For the last 10 years, he taught a workshop in memoir writing at Stony Brook Southampton College. Robert Reeves is the director of the Master of Fine Arts program in writing there.
He was an enormously popular teacher. I mean, reliably, his workshops would fill up immediately. Some days, and the very first after we offered admissions, the very first batch of mail, it would be 20 applications all for Frank.
Reeves says McCourt brought the same sense of humor and charm to his teaching that was so evident in his writing. He liked to laugh at himself, and Reeves says he enjoyed life, in spite of, or perhaps because of, the tough pitches life had thrown his way.
So in some sense, Frank's serenity may have come from the fact that he's surrounded by and had lived through so many things that would be upsetting to serenity, and so there was a willful calm and happiness. I think people can decide to be happy. Maybe that was it.
McCourt had been planning to teach the writing workshop again this summer, but he wasn't able to in the end. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You can hear Frank McCourt talk about his early years, his time at New York University, and the American dream. It's all at npr.org.
The California legislature is still struggling to close a $26 billion budget gap. One endangered program is in-home support services for more than 400,000 elderly and disabled. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has proposed cutting those services for all but the most severe cases, which could force many who are now independent to move into nursing homes. Gina Diamante of member station KVCR in San Bernardino has the story of one of those seniors.
Flora Mae King turned 102 last Sunday. She still lives alone, but she says she couldn't do it if not for an in-home support services worker who comes in 5 days a week to do the things she can't manage anymore.
I could boil some water, boil an egg, maybe.
King's one-bedroom apartment is decorated with puzzles she put together over the years.
Maybe that's why my hands are worn out. you know, jigsaw puzzles and crocheting, and I sewed. I used to sew, too. I took sewing years. I did a lot of things to prepare myself, but what good is it now when my hands are worn out?
King suffers from arthritis, shingles, and carpal tunnel syndrome, but until 2 years ago, she was still driving.
Yeah, they tell me I may not ever get over it. I'm so old now, if they take this service that I'm getting away, what would I do?
In-home support services, or IHSS, gives her 60 hours a month of extra help. Her IHSS aide does the housework and the grocery shopping. She also gets King to doctor appointments. King's care manager, Lorna Levias, says there's more to IHSS than just running errands.
They help this person survive. They remind this person to take their medicine. They help them to remember they have a doctor's appointment. Without the in-home supportive services, she's at risk for being institutionalized, which would even cost more.
King has 32 grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but living with them is not a possibility.
And they're having babies so fast and the kids are still at home. They wouldn't have any room for me.
Her doctors also don't want her to move in with family.
They're afraid I'll get pneumonia. That's just why they want me to stay away from crowds.
She can't afford assisted living. It's double what she's paying right now. At this moment, she says she's not sure what she'll do if IHSS is cut.
Whatever I could do for myself, I would do. But what could I do? Oh, boy. I hate to think what I would do. Hope I could find something in Tent City.
For NPR News, I'm Gina Diamante.
You're listening to NPR News.
Harry Potter is setting records again. The latest big screen installment of The Adventures at Hogwarts collected almost $160 million in North America in its first 5 days. That's the sixth highest opening in Hollywood history and the biggest ever for a Harry Potter film. The first five Potter films made $1.4 billion in North America alone, and more than twice that across the globe. Now, our critic, Bob Mondello, happens to be in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and he got to see Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince there. Bob, hola.
Hola, how are you?
How are you? How's the Harry Potter film playing down there?
Well, in fact, it isn't quite playing yet. It didn't open because of gripe A, which is what they call the swine flu.
Uh-huh.
But the movie theaters are operating at sort of half capacity. They're asking people to sit in every other row.
Oh, wow.
So that they're not too close together. The idea is people are not supposed to congregate.
So you saw a critic screening.
I did see a critic screening with other critics. The critics liked it, or they seemed to anyway. We were packed very close together. I hope I don't catch the flu.
I hope not either. Bob, before we talk about this film, I want to ask you about Daniel Radcliffe, who plays Harry Potter, of course. Recently, he's been doing some very adult roles on stage. On Broadway in London, he was in Equus. There was a nude scene.
Yeah.
He is now almost 20 years old, and he's playing a 16 to 17-year-old, you know, wizard. Is he plausible in this film?
Well, to the extent that wizards are ever going to be plausible, right. I suppose he is. I didn't question how old he was. The kids all look older. But these novels were built in such a way that the first one, I think we met Harry Potter when he was about 10 years old, and each new novel takes place in a new year at Hogwarts Academy of Magic. So they go through the school year, and they emerge a little bit older each time, and the actors have been doing that too. Now, the movies have mostly kept up with actual real time. I think they'll finish filming them when they're all about 21. Mm-hmm. That's still young enough to play 16 or 17 on screen. I mean, remember, they made Brad Pitt look that young in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and, you know, he's got to be in his 40s now,
right.
So it is plausible.
Right.
What's interesting, I think, is that the kids have gotten older, and they look more substantial, and so the movie becomes a little more substantial as a result.
And from the clips I've seen, Bob, it looks as if this movie really deals with teenage romance in a way that none of the other Harry Potter films have.
Well, that's true. Although I have to say, I took my 14-year-old nephew a few years ago to one of the Harry Potter movies, and Hermione, who is one of Harry's two best friends, came down some steps in a, she was all dressed up in a dress, and she was, you know, a pretty little girl to me. And my nephew looked at her and said, "She's a fox." And I thought, oh, this hadn't, you know, it just didn't occur to me that way. But clearly the audience, they've been growing up too, and so they're thinking about other things. I think there's no question that everybody is interested in romance in this one. Ron Weasley, for instance, at one point, he eats some cookies, which were intended for Harry Potter. There's a girl who's madly in love with Harry and who has sent him cookies laced with a love potion. Magic is everywhere at Hogwarts. And Ron eats the wrong ones and falls madly.
It's no joke! I'm in love with her!
All right, fine, you're in love with her. Have you ever actually met her?
Can you introduce me?
So it sounds like hormones running wild in that scene.
Totally. And actually, throughout the movie, I don't know if you've seen any of these, but there's something called Quidditch that they play in
the broomstick game.
Yeah. It's basically soccer, but in three dimensions. It takes place, you know, flying around a field on these brooms. And it's mostly played by boys. And in this one, they're all sort of looking for support from the girls who are down in the stands. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, Freud might have looked at this and said, well, sometimes a broomstick is only a broomstick, but there's, you look at it differently this time than you did in the previous ones. It inflects everything in the movie, though. I mean, the romance is very much present in it.
Now, you've liked most of the previous Harry Potter films.
Yeah, that's true.
And I understand with this one, Bob, you're actually on the same page as the movie critic for the Vatican's official paper, which formally endorsed this movie this past week.
Well, probably not for the same reasons, but I, you know, this is more an adult picture than the other ones were. And I think the audience is growing up with Harry, and it's getting to a place where the movie has to be good. It can't just be a collection of magic tricks. And this one, I think, is a pretty good movie. It kind of works.
NPR's Bob Mondello, still keeping up with the movies from Buenos Aires. Bob, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
You can see clips from the new Harry Potter movie at our website, npr.org.
Half of the football players at 120 major colleges are African American, but only 7 of the head coaches are. Now, under a new law, Oregon is the first state that requires its public colleges to include minorities in the interview process for coaches. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Ethan Lindsay has the story.
On football-crazed Saturdays in Eugene, Autzen Stadium is considered one of the loudest places in the country. Or so says former Oregon head football coach Mike Bellotti.
In fact, it's actually been verified by decibel readings on the field.
The cheers turned to jeers earlier this year when the popular Bellotti stepped down as coach. Without going through any kind of outside interview, then offensive coordinator Chip Kelly was hired to replace him. Bellotti is white, as is Kelly. Bellotti was then hired as the Oregon Ducks athletic director, also with no outside interviews. Many in the state, even Duck fans, cried foul. Partially in response, legislators here just approved a law requiring public universities interview a minority candidate for every new head coaching job.
We've kind of reached that historic moment, and Oregon is the front runner.
Richard Lapchick is the founder of the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport at the University of Central Florida.
When an opening occurs for a football coach, the athletic director rarely goes into a search mode. And as 95% of our athletic directors are also white, if they're going to turn to somebody who's part of their background, it's too often going to be another white person.
Pro Football instituted a similar rule in 2003 after Pittsburgh Steelers owner Dan Rooney pushed the league to diversify. And after the Rooney Rule was set up, the NFL saw a surge of minority hires. College football has resisted the change, until now. The sports governing body says the law could lead to token interviews and false hope, and some say the law will be challenged in court. Attorney Mitch Baker appeared on Oregon Public Broadcasting's Think Out Loud talk show.
In this case, we're talking about a law that is discriminatory on its face.
But still, Oregon's law is getting attention, even in the South, where football runs deep. Alabama Democratic Representative John Rogers says if Oregon's law translates to better coaches and more wins, his state will follow. He remembers sitting in the stands of a 1970 game between Southern Cal and an all-white Alabama team. USC's African-American running back, Sam Cunningham, ran over Alabama's defense.
From that point on, Alabama made it business to go out and recruit black ball players. Once they see it can work, it's successful. They have a lot of different attitude about hiring black coaches.
Rogers has drafted a bill similar to Oregon's that he'll introduce in Alabama next year. Legislators say they hope to do the same in other state houses around the country. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Lindsay in Eugene, Oregon.
This is NPR News.